Mr. Nelson Mandela will, within seconds appear, and that will be the moment the world has been waiting for.
In the heat of the summer of February 1990, a man walked out of prison and into a new world. Nelson Mandela, his one hand clasped in that of his wife Winnie and the other raised to the sky, took his first steps as a free man.
There's Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man, taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
He would go on to become president of a democratic, free South Africa, an icon the world over, and an inspiration to so many. When he died in 2013, he had become the father of his nation and the most famous man in the world. Well, it is the final episode of this season of Blind History, and we always try to end the season on a big person. I think last time we ended it on Jesus Christ. We're not messing around. So this episode, and we've had a lot of people asking for an episode on this guy, and I was always a little bit careful and cautious because history is something that you need a little bit of distance to be able to evaluate. There's no doubt that this person is one of the greatest people who ever lived, and especially in the context in which you and I find ourselves, Ant, South Africa. Yeah. Nelson Mandela. I know you've been very keen to talk about him too. The audience have been asking, where's your episode on Nelson Mandela? And it has been a glaring hole in the story. And in South Africa, he's probably the most famous person who's ever lived in this country.
He's the one that's made the most difference.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of pressure to do this one right. He's also the first person we've ever featured in Blind History that I've actually met. And for that reason, it's very hard to be objective like we have with all the others. Mm. You know, I can say, oh, well, wasn't it great when, you know, Napoleon did this, or wasn't it awesome when Caesar crossed the Rubicon? And I can be a little bit interested, but I didn't actually know them. And in this case, I can't claim to have known him well, but I certainly met him a few times. And I think all of us have some picture in our minds, if you've been alive for more than 10 years, of who this man was. Mm. I mean, he's still in our money.
You know, we've said in a few of our episodes, what would you do if you could go back to, let's say, Alexander the Great's tent and ask him something?
Yeah.
And in this instance here, like you mentioned, Gareth, you might have had that opportunity to ask him something, you know, in the past, because you spent whatever time with him or you met him a few times. So that's definitely something really special. Well, because in 200 years' time, 300 years' time, people will still be talking about him.
Oh, absolutely. So he was born, obviously, in the Eastern Cape in Kruno, actually born in Mvezo, and Mvezo is just a little way away from Kruno, where his grandson, Nkosi Zwelivelile Vilile Mandla Mandela, now runs that tribal and hereditary chieftainship. Nelson Mandela was born as a Xhosa aristocrat, so he grew up in a family that was quite prominent. His parents and grandparents were well known. He could recite his family history, and I heard his grandson do this orally, going all the way back to the first Abatembu chief. So this is a long and very beautiful story of a nation that started in the 1700s and possibly before, but certainly then.
And it seems, Gareth, that his early childhood was quite calm.
It was a rural, bucolic, kind of idyllic childhood. You know, he was a herd boy, like Correct. So many kids who were their first job, effectively, was to look after the livestock, which were also the economy of the family. And he did go to school early, primary school in Kruno, where he met Miss Mdingane, and she was the one who called him Nelson because he needed an English or white name.
Exactly.
But, I mean, his real name was Rolihlahla.
Yeah.
And obviously this Christian name stuck. And he was named after Horatio Nelson, who we've covered in this season.
Yes, brilliant. And aptly. But his name, his Xhosa name, I've just read that it was referring to a bent tree or troublesome as such.
Well, certainly not someone who will take nonsense lying down.
That's
kind of the idea.
Yeah.
And certainly this guy, by all available evidence was not someone who would be pushed around.
Exactly.
He obviously continued his education and actually went to a Wesleyan secondary school of some repute, matriculated there, studied a Bachelor of Arts degree at the University of Fort Hare, and went on to study law. And eventually, I mean, we're passing through some important stuff here, but set up a law firm as one of the first black lawyers in Johannesburg. And it was Mandela Tambo Lawyers,
the sign. Tambo.
You could still see photographs of the sign on the original building in Johannesburg. And they started taking on cases which were obviously important to him and to Oliver Tambo, who's another person we have to do a whole episode on. But it's pretty damn amazing how much got going so early in this guy's career and how he already knew at that point what I think his destiny would be.
Mm.
He was going to be someone who fought for the underdog. Yeah. He was going to be someone who stood up for his people.
And that was, you mentioned the law firm, that was around 1952. And I think that 1948 was where the shit hit the fan with the policies of the...
Correct.
...of the nationalist government.
Right.
And so his officers... his law firm was there to protect, you know, and he saw it firsthand. And I think effectively that's really started to build up the anger, you know, in him and the passion in him to, especially the pass laws. And later on, you know, they were onto him. You know, effectively they closed that. How many times did the security police come in and close their practice down?
Absolutely.
Etc. But that's where effectively 4 years after apartheid and officially with the name apartheid was brought on.
Well, I mean, this was the big enemy of anyone who was for freedom, for, you know, universal suffrage. And the ANC had been a party that had been established in the early 1900s. Mm. And we've spoken a little bit about some of the leaders, the early leaders of the ANC. But he was really, Nelson Mandela was the one who founded the ANC Youth League all those years ago. And he adopted at that point a much more mass-based and more radical policy than the rest, the program of action they kicked into gear in 1949. So this is all concurrent with his legal practice. And he, by then, had been married to Walter Sisulu's cousin, Evelyn, who was a nurse. They had two sons and two daughters, both of who died in infancy. But he and his wife divorced, that first wife, in 1958.
Yeah.
You know, by then, he was very much a political figure.
Yeah. And I think that was partly... the challenge created in the marriage was that he was really fighting, like you said, a political figure. He went to jail for 9 months.
Mm.
So he wasn't at home a lot. She thought he was having affairs with ANC, the people within the
women,
ANC,
yeah.
Women in the ANC. You know, it's very difficult to, I suppose, in those early years and also how we feel, but he belonged to the people, if that makes any sense. And it's tough being married to in that situation,
oh,
to somebody that belongs to the people. I mean, it's just...
You got it. Everything else comes second, right?
Agreed, 100%. And I think that probably had a lot to do with it as well.
Yeah, and there are lots of people who talk now about Mandela's personal life. And I think he was actually pretty tidy about what he did. You know, a lot of the great people in history have the most messy personal lives. Mm. And certainly when Winnie comes along later on, he put his foot down and said, no, this is not acceptable.
Mm.
You know, this is post-prison, obviously.
Yeah.
But let's just rewind the clock for a moment. So going back, he became a restricted person and was banned for the first time in 1952, which you've mentioned already. And then he had to watch in secret as they adopted the Freedom Charter at Kliptown in 1955.
Well, which he was part of.
He was, but he wasn't allowed to be, you know. And the government were really, they had their sights set on him. He was already, I think, in the same year, he was charged with the Suppression of Communism Act and their partner campaign on that front, which was obviously controversial. And he was sentenced to 9 months of hard labor. Mm. They could do that in those days. So he'd already had a stint where he was under close observation and in prison. Mm. And now they were watching him like a hawk.
Yeah.
And this is when the treason trial comes along.
Yeah. If we have to just look just during 1952, so intermittently banned, so they were like exactly like you said, they were on his back. And just imagine restricted travel, but also restricted speech.
Oh, yeah.
So it's everything against...
All communications.
All communication. And they were harassing all the anti-apartheid activists. And 100% what you did he went on trial, and I mean, but I think the trial was just a joke.
Well, it was, because ultimately all the 28 accused were acquitted, and that was in 1961. But men and women of all races found themselves there being tried. And obviously, the famous Sidney Kentridge was the man who stepped up and made the defense. And it was something that the apartheid government didn't expect. They thought their judges would do their bidding, you know, just like current politicians think the judges will do their bidding. But judges, the best ones, operate individually and independently and make decisions based on the law. But there was the Sharpeville massacre in 1969.
1960,
sorry.
But Gareth, this was the big turning point as well, because I mean, you can see definitely throughout his life, and even, you know, when he came back out of prison, he was a pacifist. He was nonviolent. He wanted to work through things in a nonviolent manner. But after the massacre in 1960, and he realized he's not going to get anywhere with the incumbent regime without more aggressive campaigns. So, and then he started to upskill himself, and he went into Africa, and look, he had to sneak around. I mean, they were onto him, and I think they called him during that time, a lot of people, because he kept evading, they called him the Black Pimpernel. So, because they could never find him, but he was on the continent. And I don't know if he went offshore, but he was definitely up in Algeria where he was trained in guerrilla tactics and all of those things. It's very much against his soul.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of controversy around this too, because this is where his reputation of freedom fighter versus terrorist becomes the talking point, which people are still debating. And obviously, that's where the line, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, comes from. But he helped establish Mkhonto we Sizwe at this point.
Correct.
You know, we've also got to remember that South Africa was under a state of emergency. There were lots of things going on. There was the banning of the ANC at that point and the banning of the PAC. There were people detained constantly for whatever reason. So it wasn't clear when you would get into trouble with who. You could be saying something, you could be sending a letter, you could just be arrested at any time for being part of this insurgency, as the old government called it. And it was at this point that he met Winnie and married her in 1958. And they had two daughters, famously Zenani and Zindi. They divorced much later in 1996, but she remained his companion through all those years that followed, the trials and tribulations of what took place next. But in the face of all the mobilization, that was where he decided it was time to take on these slightly more guerrilla tactics, which you mentioned earlier. And under the guise of Mkhonto we Sizwe, they arranged explosions and bombs were put in certain places, and it was basically civil disruption. And obviously people were killed at this point. This gave the government the opportunity to finally bring him to trial.
Yeah. So it actually wasn't a long period of time that he had the opportunity, you know, to go on to change this tactic, because he was locked up very soon afterwards. But they also found a cache of ammunition in Rivonia. So the writing was on the wall. And then he made a decision, or he always knew that he's going to stand up, accept everything, and just, he's going to tell it like it is. And I think that, you know, one of his famous speeches, you know, I'm prepared to die. That all happened. And during that type of period, it's insane what happened in those days.
Well, this is where he became, first of all, in the eyes of the old regime, notorious, but in the eyes of the people, a hero. So this is where he went to trial. Luckily, he was spared the death penalty, but he was sent off to Robben Island. And really, this is where it becomes almost legendary, because the last picture you see of him is in the 1960s. And then he becomes this enigma for 27 years, where nobody knows anything about him, only the government. They control very strictly who's allowed to go and see him. He's writing letters. He's very much involved. This is a man who's studious beyond belief. He spends his days talking, trying to work things out, trying to understand how politics works, trying to figure out the dynamics of the other prisoners on Robben Island. He's also doing hard labor, mining, you know, in the quarry there.
Yeah, and his eyes were
permanently damaged as a result of that, which was one of the reasons why, in the times I met him, there was no flash photography allowed, because
not a picnic. It was a proper hard labor.
It was awful. Robben Island was really awful. And, you know, this involves, obviously, his arrest in Howick, where there's now a monument, Lily's Leaf Farm,
yes,
here just down the road from us, Robben Island, and later on, Drakenstein Prison, where he ended up. But this is really the legendary part of his story.
Yeah, and the core celebrity, that's what that's where it came from.
Absolutely.
And if you think of the support that he garnered around the world. So we, Gareth, like you, I'm a little bit older though, but we grew up in this transition, and effectively, and if we traveled, and if I went to London, there was always some sort of peaceful, not strike, but you know, demonstration at
protest.
South Africa House.
Free protest. Mandela.
It was almost permanently at Trafalgar Square, and wherever they were, there were concerts being held, and you know, just incredible things. Even things named after him when he was in prison. You know, like a nuclear particle was named after him while he was in prison. It was just there was just that massive support, and I mean, it took the guys, the regime, a while to see that this tidal wave was coming.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. Meanwhile, while he was in prison, his mother died in 68, his eldest son in 69. He couldn't attend either funeral. They'd never let him out. Eventually went to Polsmoor and then to Drakenstein. And he started discussing things with the government. I think they realized the writing was on the wall and it was a ticking time bomb. And the first government meetings with Mandela occurred somewhere in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, because they realized also, this is, you can't keep a lid on this thing.
Mm.
It's going to explode. The whole world is against you.
Yeah.
And ultimately, there've got to be decisions made. There was obviously the referendum, which took place, the unbanning of the ANC, and then bada bing, bada boom, you got like Nelson Mandela is about to be released. Big announcement by F.W. de Klerk. Obviously, and we could go into this in some detail, but there were secret meetings being held between P.W. Botha and Mandela, the Justice Minister and various members of the ANC, and lots of these clandestine things that happened in order to bring about a more peaceful change and to avert at all costs civil war. Because the apartheid government, while they were managing certain things, and they could keep a lid on certain things, there were other things that were getting out of control. The economy, international pressure, the number of allies they had was shrinking by the day.
There was heavy sanctions.
Yeah, massive problem.
It was crippling. But also, if you couldn't control him, because they really, like you mentioned, in the 70s, they said, look, we'll release you, but on condition that you accept the status of like Transkei. Remember they made those little... Bantustans, correct. And then, but he said no. And then they came again in 10 years later, they would come back to him. So this is how long he's been in prison for, and said, if you renounce violence, you're a free man. And famously said, well, as a prisoner, I mean, I have no say. I need to be free to be able to renounce certain things. You know, so it was, they couldn't put a lid on him.
He was eventually released, and it was probably one of the most famous days in South African, if not world history. And it became, I mean, I remember being a kid. I was 10, 12, and I watched this on TV, and I just knew there was something big going on here. Everyone, everywhere who had a TV in the world was watching this. And he decided, you know, that he would run as ANC president, and eventually was elected as president of the country. He took over from Oliver Tambo, by the way, as ANC president. And he and de Klerk jointly won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993. And in April of 1994, South Africa went to the polls for its first ever democratic election. And Nelson Mandela was voted and elected our first democratic president.
And one of the things he also famously said, he was relieved that the ANC didn't get more than 66%. He said it would have just created more challenges, and because he so badly wanted it to be integrative and a collaborative. And I think that was his massive strength, a multicultural government.
Yeah. Oh,
it was insane. It was just...
By all accounts, this guy was a tremendous negotiator, but hardcore.
Yeah.
Like he could really put his foot down, and there were people who crossed him and made a mistake and never made that mistake again.
But Gareth, what one thing is where you can actually see his personality was, okay, so then now F.W. de Klerk, Say, okay, you're released, XXX. So we agree that you're going to be released on Tuesday at 10 a.m. He says, no, I will be released on Wednesday at 10 a.m. So he told them when he's going to be released. I'm not going to be released then. I'm going to be released on that day.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that we can say in terms of like interesting facts, anecdotal stories, apocryphal stuff that you don't know whether it's true or not. And this is someone who's lived in our own lifetimes. It shows you how history can change in the blink of an eye and broken telephone sets in. But I think it is fairly clear to anyone who's reading any of the historical information, newspaper articles and the rest of it, that he was managing something quite masterful here. The government of national unity, reintroducing South Africa to the international community, opening up the economy, creating opportunities for people who'd been not only disenfranchised, but had been kept out for their entire lives.
Trying to fix the imbalance, which is absolutely
we're still struggling with it now.
Yeah,
and the ANC may not have been the best vehicle for that, but this guy was extraordinary, exceptional in every way, and he had the world eating out of his hand as well. So we had moral high ground and moral capital to play with. I think that's gone. There's no way we can negotiate at the level that he used to, but that story is magical. And we'll summarize the end of his life because I don't want to go into too much detail around this. But he stepped down after one term. Again, something African leaders and dictators all over the world are loath to do. You know, they want to stay around as long as possible.
At least the second term.
Yeah. This, not him. Yeah. And Thabo Mbeki did most of the head of government stuff because Mandela was most of his time as president, really the head of state. I mean, he'd take control of some important discussions, but essentially he was our head of state. Thabo Mbeki was our head of government. And so Thabo Mbeki, you could argue, had three terms, or three and two and a bit terms. But, you know, he also has, at this point, lots of personal issues going on. When he and he divorce, he marries Graca Machel.
Yeah. Well, just the points. There's two quick points on this. So first of all, Graca Machel. You know, we spoke and gushed about Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
And she was first the Queen of France, and then she was the Queen of England. Graca Machel was basically the
First Lady of Mozambique.
And then the First Lady of South Africa, which is also quite impressive. And she was a very powerful woman in her own right. I think great energy for him in his later life.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of challenges with Winnie. She was an activist right throughout. But I have an own personal anecdote that my father-in-law actually mentioned to me. And she was banished to Brantford.
Winnie.
Yeah.
Yes.
During that time, she needed, because it's a very small little town and you can't get anything there. So she would then send her drivers to Bloemfontein to collect whatever she needed, because it's not far away. And then they would get arrested by the security police all the time. So they would be locked up in jail. And my father-in-law was an attorney, and still he's practicing an attorney in Bloemfontein. And there, Winnie's lawyer would contact him, and you know, he went and he got them released. And then Winnie would phone my father-in-law, and she was extremely grateful. And saying, you know what you've done, thank you very much. And he said he didn't do it once, twice, three times. He did it a lot. Security police were on
story.
It.
So you see, these are the stories. Yeah. Now, you see, when you get to know these people, when you actually meet the people in history, and this is why I've been reticent to do an episode like this, you get beautiful stories like that. And it colors in a lot of things in a way that we can't do for the others. So it kind of makes those stories from 1100 or whatever else seem so far away and so not human, like they've got superpowers or whatever. But I mean, his lasting legacy is obviously the ongoing democratic institutions that were established during his term as president, our constitution, the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, the Nelson Mandela Rhodes Scholarships. He died in December 2013 at the age of, 95? He had been ailing for some time at that point, but probably the biggest funeral in South African history that took place then. He's buried in Kurnu on the family farm. I don't think anyone's been allowed to visit the grave except family. It's certainly not open as a tourist attraction. But, you know, this is the greatest man in South African history. I think it's fair for anyone who's looking at the impact of somebody to put him in the top three at very least, but I'd say at number one.
I 100% agree. I think as well as just during his time when he was released, people were on him, you know, to do this and do that. It was in a Spike Lee movie.
Oh, yeah. And every celebrity in the world was flying to South Africa to meet him, and it was just exhausting. Poor Zelda, his PA, had the most difficult time just telling people no, because this is an old man who actually needed to like be with his family, eat, sleep, you know, have some time to himself.
Yeah,
having to meet every famous person who wasn't famous enough yet.
But also awards. I mean,
every award.
I mean, every single thing. There's also controversial, you know, about the Nobel Peace Prize with FW, but
yeah.
And there was a little bit of
my least favorite part of talking about Nelson Mandela is the way that revisionist historians have come along now and said he could have done more, he didn't do enough, he wasn't good enough, this guy was a sellout. You know, that's the word you hear sometimes. And this comes from highly uneducated and stupid people. There's no other way to put it.
Yeah, no, 100%
If agree. You were there, I'd like to see you have done a better job.
Yeah, I 100% agree. But I think that obviously the Nobel Peace Prize was the pinnacle, but there was just, it's insane what he did. And a father of our nation, you know, that we were passionate about sport as a nation. He was passionate about sport. He felt that sport could transgress unite all people. And could unite people. And in fact, it really, really did. And whenever, I just felt, whenever he attended a match, and it actually, there wasn't a Springbok match that he did attend that we did not win, so we won all of them.
So he was the magic child.
Yeah, yeah. So then, and then when he wasn't attending, I thought, oh no.
It's going to go bad.
Yeah, yeah. So, but effectively, I mean, he was such a great brand ambassador.
I know that this is not objective, but I'm going to quote from the Nelson Mandela Foundation in their line describing him. At the end of their biography, Nelson Mandela never wavered in his devotion to democracy, equality, and learning. Despite terrible provocation, he never answered racism with racism. His life is an inspiration to all who are oppressed and deprived, and to all who are oppressed to oppression and deprivation. And I think that's probably more well put than anything I could write.
Yeah, I can't add to that.
Beautiful. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History. Every episode is available on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.